day, judging variance, tensor model. And this work can be also see in archive, it is the number. First, I will give on previous result with another collaborator, Fabien Vintouneret, on the renormalization of tensor field theory. And in second part, I will compute the beta function of the model. And I prove that the physics 5 and five, six model are asymptotically free in the UV regime. Okay, what is the field that we consider? It is the field who take value on the copy of arbitrary group J. And we also assume the George invariant condition. This condition is given by my relation 2. If we assume that the group J is U1, then the field phi can be expanding on the Fourier transformation, and this transformation is given by this relation. Phi P is the Fourier transform of phi G1, G2, GD. And P is equal to P1, P2, PD. P take a value on Z. Now, the propagator that we consider in our models is given by this relation. And we have a simple modification with the previous presentation. This quantity is due to our George invariant condition. And the propagator can be represented by the D-strand given in my figures. Okay, the locality principle permit to define the vertices and the propagator and the vertices of the model. Now we consider the action of phi 4 model that's given by the first relation. In this relation, in this relation, phi bar 6, 5, and so on, is the complex conjugate of the field of phi. And the vertices, the vertex is represented by this quantity. We also define the action of our second model. This action is given by relation 5. And we have, in this case, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 vertices. Okay. The previous vertices, V41, V4, V41, 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 And we can also remark that we have the cyclic permutation due to the strand index that we give is the index who take value on 1, 6, 1 prime, 6 prime. Okay. Now, what is the representation of our vertices? In the first, if we consider the first model, the phi 6-4 model, the vertex data we identify is this one. And in this vertex, we can see the strand index We are we 1, 2, I think, yes, 6. Okay. The index in the number represents the standard index. Okay. Also, in the second case, we have 4 vertices. This one, this one, this one, and this vertex. Okay. I want also say that this vertex represents the anomalous vertex that appear when we want to renormalize the model. Using the multi-scale analysis, we can show that the divergence degree of Feynman graph associated to our tensor model is given by relation 11. In this relation, L represents the number of lines of the Feynman graph, F is a number of faces, and R is the rank of matrix epsilon LF, this matrix, who take value 1, minus 1, and 0, depend on the case that the line is included on the face, the line is not included on the face. Okay, now using the topological property of the Feynman graph, we can also obtain this relation. It is a topological property of the graph who permit me to give to obtain the relation. In this relation, it is important to emphasize that omega tilde represent the sum over the genus of the jacket associated to the graph G. Omega, this one, is the divergence degree of the boundary graph of G, and C is a number of connecting components of the boundary graph of J. We can also compute this relation. In this relation, I wanted to tell attention on this quantity. This quantity is given by this relation, the number of faces minus the rank minus D minus 2, the number of line minus the number of vertices plus 1. Okay, and Caruza show what is the property of this quantity. I don't give us in my presentation. Okay, using the divergence degree that I presented previously, we can show that the two models that we consider is renormalizable at all other of on perturbation. And the divergence graph is represented by this table. Okay, finally, we go to compute the beta function associated to the two model, the above two model that we consider. Okay, we give the first theorem, the wave function renormalization of the phi sys 4 model is given by this relation, and in this relation, E represented the logarithmic divergence quantity. It is this one, and we can also compute the 4-point function, who is the amputated one PE 4-point function, who is given by this relation. We have also E. E is the same quantity. And if we compute the quotient of gamma and Z, we can obtain the renormalizable coupling constant given by the next relation. And the beta function is minus this quantity. You can also remark that The renormalizable coupling constant is greater than the bare coupling constant. And this shows that the model is asymptotically free in the UV region. Finally, we can also compute the renormalizable the renormalized coupling constant associated to the second model. And in this model, we have two coupling constants that interest us is lambda 6.1 and lambda 6.2. And in the two relation, beta 1, beta 1, 2, beta 2, beta 2, 1, represent the beta function that we interest. And E is also the logarithm divergence quantity, that is this one. Okay, and the beta 1, beta 1, 2, beta 2, and beta 2, 1 is given by the this relation. I don't want to show you why we obtain the relation 20 and 21. And you can also remark that in this situation, lambda 6.1 run is greater than lambda 6 bare. Lambda 6.1 bare and lambda 6.2 run is also greater than lambda 6.2 bare. And we conclude that this model is asymptotically free in the UV regime. Thank you for your attention.
That was short, and we have time for questions. Yes.
In the 5-6 model without U1 invariance, well, I don't remember these computations because they were a bit technical, but there was there were some sectors which were there was a no coefficient, I think, between lambda 2, lambda 1, or there was something of this kind. And is there this feature also here?
Yes, there is a mixing. Yeah,
you are the specialist, maybe you should answer.
No, it's the second one. The second one.
The second one, okay.
Yeah.
So there was one coefficient which was zero, or?
No.
Ah, yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Seems to me there was one of these. There are beta 1, 2 or beta 2, 1.
Yes. Well, that's not the same model, obviously, but at one loop, the first, the one beta function is vanishing for the 5-6 simple.
Exactly.
Yeah, at one loop, but you have to compute up to two loops for having
five. And why is it that this feature, which was true in our model, is no longer true in that model?
Why
do you know that, or any of you has an answer?
He's asking about why we have a special cancellation that happened for the 5-6 simple. At that level, you just find that lambda 6.1 equals lambda 6, lambda 6.1 run equals lambda 6.1. Mm. That was a monstrous cancellation that was happening, but here it doesn't happen. And Vincent is asking you,
is there a symmetry that is no longer there here? Or?
Yes, well, I think that the propagator is radically different. Okay, even
sure.
Yeah, and that even the types of divergences, the logarithmic divergences, are quite involved here. You decide, you see, I pi to the free, that doesn't even happen for the previous model. So there are. The least that I can say is that, well, both models are not comparable. They belong to two categories of different models.
And the first, the beta 1, 2, or whatever was vanishing in the other model, is it the first of an infinite sequence of vanishing terms, or you don't know? Because this zero, was it completely accidental, or is it the sign of a certain kind of thing?
Oh, it was at the point. Okay, it was, for instance, the beta 1 there, which was zero, and there was no mixing between lambda 6.1 and lambda 6.2.
Yeah,
meaning,
interesting.
Yeah, so there was no any. How can I say? At one loop, you are not able to generate the lambda 6.1 coupling using the lambda 6.2. Okay, so that was very special.
Mm.
And so that mixed term doesn't happen, but in the second kind of equation, you just have that cross term to lambda 6 1, lambda 6.
Yeah, so I would wonder that it would suggest as a good interesting question to try to see whether there was a symmetry in the other model which is broken there or what was expected.
Yeah,
perhaps it's a question for the future.
Yeah, another question maybe. Okay, let's thank the speakers.
You have to dress up. More or less. Okay.
All right. Second speaker would be Lorenzo.
Yes.
Is.
I happen Lorenzo to be Lorenzo.
From AEI, you're going to talk about, well, how can you think about condensates in GFDs?
Yes. So first of all, many thanks for the possibility of giving, now again, this talk. Actually, I'm going to present, what is the, here. I'm going to present some work that we have done in collaboration with Stefan Gillen from the PI and Daniele on possible implication of GFT dynamics and states coming from GFT on for cosmology. So we will try to do some physics. And the reason why we are interested in to this sort of problem is, of course, because we believe that somehow GFT should capture some features of a microscopic theory of space-time. And this is because basically its dynamics, its phase equation, somehow encode the sum of the triangulations that we want to have in a formulation, a path integral formulation for gravity. In this talk, in this work, basically what we do, we take these two steps for granted. We identify some special class of states within GFT. And we establish a connection between these states and essentially the mini superspace sector of gravity that is Friedmann Robertson Walker geometry or Bianchi cosmologies. We put everything together and we try to get an effective, possibly quantum cosmology or some Friedmann equation for the geometry associated with these states. Of course, this is a proposal for a more ambitious program that is to pass directly from GFT to GR in some way. It is very well possible that what I'm going to present is not quite correct, that it's possible there are other arrows towards this endpoint, but we try to do what we can. So the background, I won't spend a second basically on the details of group field theory. What I'm just going to use is the Fock structure that Daniele has presented already. So I'm going to use the field operators as ladder operators. I'm going to consider a very abstract, very general form of the equation of motion. I'm not going to spend a minute explaining who these kernels are. Basically, these kernels will encode the detail of the spin foam model, essentially, that you want to include in a GFT, and the perturbative expansion, the partition function that we have seen many times today, is just translated in the application of the Wigg theorem for all these ladder operators whenever we consider expectation values of these guys here. So the equation of motion, I stress, is an equation of motion for the quantum state. So the geometric content of this theory is, or at least at the kinematical level, is has been already explained. A field operator is associated to, in this case, the creation operator is associated to the creation of a tetrahedron with certain geometric data. In these cases, I'm using fluxes or bivectors. that are going to be to satisfy some closure relation because we impose some gauge invariance requirement in this on these field operators. When you have simplicity constraints, as in spin foam models, you discover that these bivectors are actually bivectors. That is, see, they are wedge product of triads, essentially. And basically, with these piece of information, you can associate to the geometric data that you put here as triad, really what we call geometry, that is a metric, actually a metric in a given reference frame that, for convenience, we will assume to be given by the edges, three independent edges of a tetrahedron. So this is the case in which you want to create a tetrahedron with well-specified data, so with the data B1, B2, B3, B4, essentially picked on these classical values. If you want to have a smooth state, you can convolve the field operator with what essentially is the wave function for the metric via the translation provided by the metric G. Very good. So, as I said, the metric tensor GIJ is still a metric tensor in with respect to the given triad. In order to translate this into a real metric tensor, I need to define what is the triad itself. So for this, so to translate an internal metric to a space-time metric, or a space metric in this case, I'm going to use an embedding procedure that is a will identify. I will take, first of all, as a sort of embedding manifold, a group manifold, because we want to discuss homogeneous cosmologies, so homogeneous spaces. And we are going to embed this tetrahedron in such a way that the edges are aligned with a choice of left invariant vector fields over this manifold. So as we discussed already a couple of times during the conference, in this picture of group field theories or tensor models, the continuum limit is associated to an operation in which you take a lot of these little guys. I won't spend a second on this part. I just want to make a restriction on this continuum limit or operation of taking a lot of tetrahedra, saying we take a lot of tetrahedra that are all identical. They are basically, I'm going to take a large number of copies of the same object in such a way, basically, the metric reconstructed with this embedding procedure is a homogeneous metric on the group manifold that so far is completely unspecified. So is a background structure that we are putting in. Actually, this is a kind of slightly unpleasant feature. It's something that we are putting in by hand. But we hope that the structure, the group manifold that we need, will be determined self-consistently by the procedure that I'm going to describe. So basically, so far, what we have done, we have constructed or given the recipe to construct quantum state in GFT that are associated to homogeneous, possibly anisotropic cosmologies. So two possible implementations of these ideas are these states here, sigma and psi, that we call GFT condensates because of analogies that we have with the aerodynamics of Bose-Einstein condensates. And they are associated to elementary structures that we can reconstruct or that we can find in the literature also in loop quantum gravity and spin foams, that is an open spin network vertex in this case, or a dipole in this other case. So if you want to read more about, for instance, how they use the dipole in LQG and spin foam to get some form of cosmology, here are the papers with some cutoff, unfortunately. So as I said, the two functions, sigma and psi, are describing the wave function of the geometry for this single tetrahedron. So they really allow us to compute all the expectation value that we might want to compute, that is, you know, in this case here, H is can be parallel transport can be, you can be interested into the say the bivector across a phase, or you can be interested, as we are, in the expectation value of the internal metric that is associated to stuff like scale factors, for instance. And this will be done, you know, in this case, I'm considering the scale factor as well, by taking these, essentially these sort of expectation values, as Daniele has already shown. Anyway, the strategy is clear. We have candidate states for cosmologies. We have the dynamics. Let's put them together. And we ask that these states here satisfy the equation of motion. So these states that we are writing here are satisfying the equation of motion of GFT that I've written some slides ago. Essentially, this equation become equation of motion for the function sigma or psi that we have already seen, and they're obtained essentially by taking expectation value of C, that is the constraint imposing the equation of motion, and O are generic operators of creation and annihilation operators. An inspection of these equations shows that, among other things, you get something that resembles a Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Actually, so Wheeler-DeWitt equation in the sense that it is an equation for, in this case, the single vertex wave function. This is it. So this is what the theory tells you. However, we are not really happy with this conclusion. This is very implicit. What we want to see is something like an equation for the expectation values that are associated to these wave functions, like an equation that relates the average scale factor, the average Hubble parameter, and possibly other objects, such that we can make a comparison with classical GR or modification, that is, equations a la Friedman written in this way. In order to do this, we have to be a bit more explicit and try to pick up a model. If you take, instead of the single field, the single vertex, you take the dipole, you might end up with a Wheeler-DeWitt-like equation of this form, or in this case, one of the kernels that appear in the initial initial action. And if you take for this kernel one of one very simple choice, it is actually motivated by also renormalizability argument. You take Laplacian basically on four copies of SU2, for instance. Imagine that we are doing Riemannian quantum gravity. And if you try to explore the WKB limit of this, so this equation when you plug in this guy here, and you restrict to the WKB, to the dominant term in the WKB expansion, you do a little bit of computation. You remember who is B with respect to the scale factors, who is pi, that is the group element, with respect to the conjugate momenta, that is basically the Hubble parameter. And therefore, you can get something like the Friedman equations, Friedman equation, where this C here is just a combination of various integration constants that are state dependent, but they are real, so this number is positive. P, as I said, is the conjugate momentum to the scale factor, and A is the scale factor in the isotropic sector. Let me remark that all this procedure works in the anisotropic sector. So here I'm just for simplicity presenting the isotropic one, but there is no this, in fact, we have the equation for the full thing. So here we are moderately happy. We have translated the rather implicit equation for the wave function for the geometry into an explicit equation for the averages. And so we can start asking ourselves if it has something to do with physics. Well, in this case, yes. If you look at GR textbooks, you discover that these, so it is is A4, because A equal to 0 is a spurious solution, as you can see if you insert matter. This equation is just the Friedmann equation for a universe with positive curvature, positive spatial curvature. And then self-consistency it tells us that the group manifold in which we embedded this tetrahedra is SU2. So, nice. And somehow this is telling us that this picture that I draw, this diagram that I draw at the beginning makes some sense. However, what I think is worth discussing is the significance of this calculation for the development of effective field theories. And that is the clarification of the limitations of what we have done. So first of all, it is necessary that in order for this nice game that we play to work, it is necessary that the tetrahedra are kept small, so almost flat. Small with respect to the curvature radius, or the Hubble radius, if you want. Then, actually, we should be careful and look at the equation for all the equation of motion that are, all the equations, sorry, for the correlation functions that are implied by the equation of motion. There, in the previous slides, I just focused on one of them, but there are a tower of them, because so the equation of motion for GFT is an equation for the state. So we can decide, for instance, that so we are lucky, we find a solution. We are not so lucky, but and we don't get a solution. But we can estimate the errors that we make if we get if we use these states. So I guess that I'm running out of time. So let me just go to the final comments. So I would like to stress that the procedure that I've discussed is completely general, doesn't really depend on the specific spin form model of GFT models that you like. Of course, the explicit solution might depend on that. We might need the insights from LQG and spin forms in order to get to the result, because as I said, as I showed you, we are using the geometric insight from the LQG data. What is important I think radically different with respect to previous attempts to do these kind of things in quantum gravity is that we don't have really a background lattice in game. We have this embedding manifold that we need to make sense of things, but then the states are still sum over very simple triangulations, but in a sense, they are not fixed. The other nice thing is that all these kind of routine can give us the opportunity to control the approximation that we make and the error on the resulting Friedmann equation. So this procedure tells us, in principle, how much we can trust the results. So, thank you.
Questions? I have a question about
sure.
Quantum CPUs.
Yes.
So can you go back to the slide?
Absolutely.
So can I interpret, so I see that for the second one you drew there a dipole.
Yes.
But the condensate is an exponential of this dipole or something.
Yes, okay. So basically, this operator psi is an operator that creates this dipole with the contraction given by this wave function. The exponential acting on this vacuum state is simply creating a state that is a superposition of an arbitrary number of these disconnected dipole, yes.
Yeah, I wanted to understand if they're disconnected dipole.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think I've made a terrible mistake and I've erased a picture that was essentially tried to convey the message that you just observed, that the state that we are picking up are really all these little guys all over the place. And that's why we need, that's why we don't have a fixed background triangulation. We have these units of triangulation, if you want, but there is still, there are still arbitrary ways, all the arbitrary ways to put these little guys on the manifold.
Question?
Ah, I'm sorry.
Thank you. All right, go on. Let's head on. Yeah, yeah, long game. Voilà, tu souffres beaucoup et tu sois là. Il ne morde pas. Pas pour l'instant. Tu connais un peu la manière. Ça, c'est le pointeur. Celui qui est en haut, c'est le pointeur. Tu vois, c'est un pointeur. Avant, arrière, avant.
Et ça, oui.
Bon, ça va être certain pour les trucs. Alors,
all right. Next speaker is Stéphane Dartois from RPT Austria and Viltanus. He will talk us. He will talk about a double scaling limit. How can you think about it? All right.
Okay. Thanks for the introduction, Joseph. So yeah, I will introduce a recent work that I have done with Razvan and Vincent on the double scaling limit for tensor models. So this is the equivalent of a double scaling limit for matrix. The difference is that it works, actually. So here is just the outline of my talk. So first, I will just introduce and motivate maybe this work, give the definition, general framework of tensor models. That it has already been presented by a lot of people here, so we'll go fast on this part. And we have been interested in a tensor model with a quartic interaction, so I will just present the interaction term. Then I will just talk a bit about loop vertex expansion, which is a framework which has been first developed by Vincent and then used and maybe improved by Razvan and adapt to tensor. Because we use the graph of this loop vertex expansion to track the 1/n factors and then to reach the double scaling limit. Then I will just tell what is the double scaling limit and introduce the combinatorial tool we use to understand this new graph and classify them. And just tell you what are the leading graphs in this scaling and how we resume them and the result we obtain. And I hope I can conclude at the end. So just to introduce, so we have first the large n limit of matrix models. So I think that everyone here just know what is the large n limit of matrix models. So I will just recall that if you compute the two-point function in this limit, then you have to sum over all planar graphs. So there are graphs which represent the sphere. And so we can compute the critical exponent. And we see that there is a critical point, and we can compute the critical exponent. And we know that all spheres, but only spheres, survive in this limit. So for string theory purpose, it has been interesting to look at what we call double scaling limit, because it has been thought that it could be a way to define the sum over all topology and then to define non-perturbatively the string theory, but actually it doesn't work because it's not summable and not even Borel summable. So we have this kind, we can just set this scaling kappa as n at the power of 5/4 and time lambda minus lambda c, which is the critical point of the planar sector, to enhance the contribution of other topology, so no sphere, and try to sum that, but it doesn't work. So after that, there has been study on tensor model, and we can try to repeat this framework. So find a single scaling. So as it has been, the fact is n is the size of the matrix, so we can try to do an expansion in the size of the tensor. And for color model, it has been found that there is such a single scaling limit. So it's we sum over graph which are mullions, and they represent sphere, a very specific kind of sphere, so not all sphere. And then we can compute their Hausdorff dimension and everything, and we find that they correspond to branch polymer. So it's a bit disappointing. And maybe if we can find a kind of double scaling limit for a tensor model, we can extract more sphere and change the Hausdorff dimension, spectral dimension, and everything. So the tensor models, so the very general framework is now we can just write an action and on tensor, and we just write it as a polynomial of tensor un, so just for second notation, I don't put the power, the tensor power here, but it's a un tensorial d invariant. And actually, matrix is a tensor, so you can see the invariant, which is the trace, and you can represent this invariant as a graph, so color graph, because you have to keep track of the indices. So to each color, you have you make correspondence with one indices of your matrix, and you see that they are cycle actually. But for tensor, then you have much more invariants, because you have much more contraction patterns. So again, you find some invariants which are represented as colored graph, and you see that just for pi-4 interaction, then you already have much more invariant. You have just one for matrices, basically, and you have plenty for tensor. Here you have a 5-6 interaction, and you can go on like that. So we have been interested in the T4 tensor model. So we take just a T bar interaction, and we say that it's mullionic because we can see that it's a mullion graph. And so here I put the color graph corresponding to it. So we have the zero line, which come here, actually. And this is the vertex. And so here I just put what is called the intermediate field representation. So you have a sigma field, which is a matrix field. And that's what is used in a loop vertex expansion. So basically, just one write the interaction term as something of this form. It's not exactly that because it's a bit bigger to write. Actually, you can see you have this sigma field, which is one for each color. And because you have to sum over all this invariant with all color here. And then you can use that to re-express your tensor model in terms of a field theory on sigma field. So you can look after that at the Feynman graph of this new theory. And actually, the edges of this graph are made of sigma field, and the vertices are made of the former propagator. One interesting point is that all the vertices can be of any degree. And so, okay, it's not really my point here, but it's constructive because it allows you to implement the Borel sum of the perturbation series. And so what it says is that it's just convergent. And in the tensor framework, it's very convenient because mullions become trees in this representation. And so actually, you could look at that as, so I said that here you have the sum over plane trees, and here you have the sum over graph, which are which has these trees here included in them. So you have to put this weakening factor to avoid overcounting of the graph. And you have the amplitude of your graph. And so one in very interesting point is that in this framework, you can see the graph as a set of loop on a tree. And in the case of tensor, you can track the 1 over n factors just by tracking the number of loop and the kind of loop, because loop has color and. So what is really a double scaling limit? So if you look at the two-point function, you have your Mullenic part, and then you can sum over the other graph. And you can see that they come with some more 1 over n factor and 1 lambda minus lambda c term. And what you want is to fine-tune these two parameters in such a way that this is minimal. This ratio is minimum. So if you choose the good scaling, this then you can extract the graph for which this ratio is the minimum one. Yeah, I just put it. So what we have done is just to introduce some combinatorics tool, and so to understand the graph of the LV. So we introduce two procedures. And so we have pruning, and so we take a graph, then, like here, and you reduce all the tree part of your graph. Okay. Actually, you can compute this amplitude directly, but if you want to do it just graph by graph, then it's a bit tricky.
Maybe you should point that there is a little thing there which means.
Oh yeah, I forgot to tell why. Yeah. So you have this this very special vertex, and it means one thing is that when you have just a tree, so forget this loop, then it gives you rooted plane trees, and it comes from the fact that you compute the two-point function. And so the pruning is just that you erase this part, you know, this tree part, and you don't erase this because it comes from it's your root vertex. So you obtain a new graph, and after that you can make the reduction. So you take all these vertex, which has degree 2, and you erase them, putting just a bar. And what you can do is to take this new reduced graph and undo them with a new Feynman rules. And these Feynman rules will take into account the fact that you have a several graph that project onto this one. And so they will, if you compute the amplitude of this reduced graph with this Feynman rule, so basically, you have a new propagator that sums over all these things that you can have, like that. And if you use these Feynman rules, then you obtain as an amplitude of a reduced graph, the sum of all the amplitude of the graph that projects onto it.
Sorry, can I ask you? So, and I meant to think of propagator as essentially, you know, the sum up of all the melons that could be inserted.
Yeah, actually, that's it. Okay. Yeah. So it's just the generating function of of trees. So we can identify the leading graph, and the important feature is that it's valid for a dimension d which is smaller than 6. And it was really unexpected. So we can identify the family of graph which has this minimal ratio and then set the double scaling variable as 2, and so the 2 is just for convenience, but you can erase it if you want, n times lambda minus lambda c, where this is the critical point of Mullins. And if you set x to be finite and n goes to infinity, then you enhance the contribution of the graph, the identified family. So this family is just the one which maximizes the number of one peer bar at fixed number of loops, and with the condition that the loops are monocolor. So what does I mean by that? If you take this graph, then you have the color of your sigma field on the edge. And when you project to the radius graph, then you see that this project to this part, you know. So if all these edges have the same color, then this edge here is said to be monocolored. And if there is, say, this of color 1, here 2, and then 2 again, so this is not monocolor anymore. So you want the loop to be monocolor, and you can compute, the amplitude of what we call cherry trees, so the graph that are in this family. And moreover, you can compare this this amplitude to the amplitude of the other graph, and boom, the contribution of the amplitude of non-cherry graph. Yes. Where?
In the final equation, and the mean when this is the central part of the eigen 6, the x variable there is the power t minus 2 times lambda minus lambda t. And h by e minimal is d minus 2.
Right. Actually, I don't see what you are saying. Just
h by e minimal is d minus 2. You gave us the formula in d equals 3. So.
This?
Up.
Oh, yeah, here, yeah, that's it. Okay. Okay, yeah, it's d minus 2 in d dimension. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The case d equals 3 something.
Yeah, I forgot to. I just remarked for this. And so you can bound this contribution and see that it's smaller than for the cherry trees. And a priori, it's non-trivial since it corresponds to a lot of LV graph and not just one graph. And so what is a cherry tree? So it's a kind of binary trees with a cherry at the end, you know. And we can reason them since they are counted by a Catalan number and obtain the two-point function in this limit. So we have a new critical point, which is xc equal 1 over d minus 1. So you could take care of this factor 2 here, but actually it just comes from this factor 2 here. So it's just the 2 of convenience. So you see that the critical point has just shifted. So to conclude, the double scaling limit so allows to compute sum over more triangulation. But the sum still runs over spheres. So actually, cherry trees are spheres. You can easily show it. And as already noticed by Guro in the analysis of the toy model for double scaling, the physical interpretation of the new scaling variable is not really clear as compared to GR and the case of a matrix model. The critical exponent of cherry trees is 2.1 is or still 1/2, so the one of branch polymer, but we don't know about the Hausdorff dimension and the spectral dimension of these cherry trees. So maybe we have to investigate this further. And we could be interested in multiple scaling limits as a way to sum over more and more graph and more triangulation and maybe more topology. And if you want to have the details of the computation, then you can find it on archive. And you could also be interested in a parallel work by Razvan again and Gilles Schaeffer. And yeah, which is interesting because it considers a bigger set of graphs. So thanks for your attention.
Yes, so it's on these cherry trees that you had on the slide. So maybe it's the first time I've seen them. So if I wanted to get something like that wasn't branch polymers, I want to get something like let's say the Brownian sphere or something, is it that I would want to have loops that are slightly more non-local? So those occur at the end of the tree, right?
Yeah. That's
so I want to join branches that are.
That's why it's likely to be, again, branch polymer. But we don't know about the behavior of the distance of this on these trees. I mean, because when you look at the distance of the melonic trees, then you know that it's not exactly the distance in the triangulation. You have to do some work, you know, to. And in that case, we don't know anything about how we translate distance in the triangulation on the cherry trees, so may be different, but it's likely to not.
This cherry tree, in fact, you need to see that it represents a whole family of things.
That was my question. I mean, there are probably branches that are deleted, right?
Yeah.
So.
Is just melons, you know. So what it tells you is that these are just two dipole at some very local point in your direct graph. So, it's bunch polymer, but it's likely to be. But one has to do more work to understand that.
My impression was that you derived the Brownian sphere from the continuum random tree by joining these things.
Yeah.
Joining their leaves.
Yeah.
So the thing is that if you decorate this by other trees inside, the loop, which seems very small, now will become slightly larger. Now, probably, presumably, you know, not large enough, but certainly it will become slightly larger than what you see. You know, like it's a bit an illusion that you see like a small thing hanging there. You know,
right. Decorated. Yeah. It's much more decorated.
But I have another question here. How can you see why the matrix model downscaling doesn't work? How can I see?
Oh, okay. It's just because of. Just because of this behavior, the behavior of that. So everything is positive, and you sum something which is factorial h.
No,
so.
I mean, whenever are you working in any dimension, in any rank, or in fixed rank? Is this work are you in rank 3 or rank 4?
You mean for tensor?
What's the of your vertex at the initial level?
What is the?
The number of color.
Okay, I don't fix the number of colors.
So,
it's everything in D
dimension. Do you have something like D minus 2 somewhere, something like this, which tells you
it comes here. You have a D minus 2, and if you look at this, then you can see that you have a problem.
Okay, good. Okay. Well, let's thanks again.
Sauf le fait que tu n'as pas assez de trucs là, en fait c'était plutôt pas mal.
Oui, je sais. Je suis désolé.
No,
not yet.
It
doesn't
work.
Maybe
more fun if I introduce myself. In fact, I've put a lot of pressure on the speaker so that I can have more time now to say it.
It's funny if you are very formal introducing yourself.
I think I will manage. All right. So.
It's a pleasure.
No. All right. Well, I don't do that. But anyway, that's me. I'm Joseph, and I will talk about actually the space of a normalizable model in the simplest way that you can think it, I mean the simplest tensorial group field theories, including even matrices. So if I any transition, well, I will have 2 points here trying to motivate renormalization in this framework, what has been achieved so far, and what actually in my second point I would like just to update the list of models and additional new features. Oh, by the way, I didn't cite, okay, you can find the first part of this work in that archive number, pointer, yeah, in there. But at the end, I will have some, you know, future prospects, and that has been done in collaboration with Sanjay Rangulam, which was visiting PI a few times, in a few weeks ago. So let's go. Mm-hmm. Now. All right, you recognize quite this slide. It's just the expression that tensor model, a generalization of matrix models, very famous in the mid-80s for describing quantum gravity in 2D. Well, mainly you have that partition. Oops, all right, no. Oops, right. There. You have that partition function, well, which just express the sum of all possible random triangulation that you can have on surfaces. Well, one main thing that you have to understand is for achieving continuum limits and something and analytical result, you need a powerful tool that has been called the 1/n expansion of Tuft, and that allows you mainly to project on a particular sector of partition function, mainly planar graphs or surfaces of genus zero. Well, people try to generalize those ideas in higher dimension, for instance, in 3D, which is the simplest situation that you can think of. You want to triangulate a 3D space. Basic building blocks that you can use is a tetrahedron. So you use that particular object, okay, as your interaction, and that object is made with four triangles, and well, you associate to that triangle what we call a tensor, okay, of rank three in that particular instance. And this, tensor, that representation, that graphical representation is made with three strands, and well, you can look those strands as just, you know, the edge of this triangle. Well, and people try to have the same beautiful result about, well, continuum limits, you know, scaling, double scaling, something like this, and it turns out to be just a nightmare or a challenge. but because, well, of the missing 1/n expansion, which allows you to understand properly, how can you, well, understand the partition function? Well, that has been solved in an incredible piece of work by Razvan. And now we have a 1/n expansion. And don't worry, if you cannot read the word in the top, that's just mnemonic because you are not an initiated. All right, so and how does it work? Well, first of all, you introduce an extra index on your tensor. That was the first. And now you integrate over all colors but one. And now you end up with, just understand them as just tensor with, you know, separate indices, distinguished indices. Well, from that and over consideration, you can perform your 1/n limit. And well, you discover that the most dominant contribution in that partition function is just dominated by very particular types of triangulations of sphere in any dimension. That's the result. You've looked at those types of graph. These are what we call a melons. Okay, they are kind of colored graph. You can think of them as just colored graph. Actually, these are the generalization of, well, unitary invariance for tensor as much as, well, the proper, you know, before you have trace M dagger M to the P, which was the invariance for matrices. So that's the generalization, and there are many of them. All right, so the purpose of renormalization is just to understand the types of divergences that you can have in this partition function. And actually, you have to introduce a proper kinetic term in order to damp those divergences. And that has been done. And this is, if you wish, the up to recent works, the types of model that we have. Mainly, I can divide it into two categories. What I call here gauge invariant tensor models, which are up there, that has been discussed by Sylvain in the renormalization group session. It explained that particular, where is it again? There we go, here. Okay, it explained that model, which is quite recent and the most advanced model that we have in presently. It's a work of Sylvain, Daniele, and Vincent. But I will focus here on the top here. And mainly, I can see two types of model which are normalizable. The one which are very simple here, without any particular. You just put here a Laplacian on your field, or more a slight modification of that. Or what I call here anisotropic model that we have found with Etera, that allows you, well, to change the rank of your theory without spoiling your renormalizability. So this was actually the space of model that you would like to investigate. And well, okay, another feature, all right, and that's about the asymptotic freedom. It turns out that in the UV regime, large spins, well, all those models turns out to be asymptotically free. Well, is that a generic feature? All right, that was a question that I was wondering, asking myself. And it turns out that before you ask about genericity or something, is it generic, you have to tell me what's your space of model, all right? In which sense do you understand your space of model? And for that, well, you have to explore. I need to explore my space of model, and exploring is about freedom, all right? So what's my freedom allowed? All right, I think about it a lot, and I say, okay, the only thing that I can have a good control of it is three things that I have a good understanding of that. So I have three initial constraints. My field would be are defined on a compact group, either U1 to the D or SU2 to the D. With that, well, I avoid IR divergences. That doesn't mean that, well, we cannot think about something else, okay, but to this point, that's a simple assumption. It would be actually very interesting to look at the non-compact case, you know, Lorentzian group up here, or even R to the D. Anyway, but here, in this analysis, I will restrict to that group. Second point, the propagator is what I call stranded. It means a sum of kind of momenta like this, P to the A, where that P is nothing but the representation of that groups. And that little a is just a free parameter between 0 and 1. One at one, you exactly recover a kind of Laplacian on your group. And well, less than one, that would be for something that we think about more and more, is achieving a kind of Osterwalder-Schrader positivity. And you need a power of your Laplacian, well, to be less than one, right? So that would be an important stuff. But in fact, when we compute the problem, well, it turns out that A is severely constrained. Okay, it cannot take any continuum value, but only rational value. All right, we got to come back on that. Yeah,
it can be bigger than one.
It can be, but what I need in my analysis is just to bound that A, all right, up to some point. And if you have, if it's bigger than A, well, certainly I can have more models. But if you want. Actually, if you want to achieve more physical insight, like, you know, recortation in time, something like this, well, that could be a strong requirement that you can ask on your kinetic term. What about the interactions? Well, the interactions are chosen to be unitary trace invariant in the previous sense, and you heard that a lot in this conference. Why? Because so far, it's the only class of interaction that we found renormalizable. Okay, you cannot tweak that. Okay, it's something that is done. There are some investigation in going. Well, I would not bet on that anyway. But certainly, this also can be a point of investigation. Is it possible to generalize that invariance to something else? Anyway, so let's go.
Just to comment there. In matrix theory, you have usually three main ensembles, orthogonal, unitary, and symplectic.
Yeah.
So we might imagine.
Ah, also. Yeah. Okay, nice, simple, yeah. All right. So I pick here my fields, phi, over these little d copies of my group GED here. So here, well, that's the rank of your theory, like little d, and that's our complex value field. You Fourier decompose the guy, and you're going to use that particular kinetic term, okay, just sum over all possible momenta, and this is exactly what I call a stranded propagator. Okay, you sum over all possible values of that piece, where that piece can be anything like that for U1, or, you know, a power of your Laplacian on SU2. That's it. all right, this is what you can achieve after a multi-scale analysis. Well, you have to do the whole stuff, you know, multi-scale analysis, find your power counting theorem quite rigorously, and try to understand your degree of divergences. So,
could they get make a comment?
Or yes.
When the model is super normalizable, that was the case in the early days of constructive theory, one can consider that it is power-like asymptotically free in the ultraviolet. Because if you take a dimensionless coupling, that goes very rapidly.
Yeah.
So we could sort of say that they are also.
All right.
For a different reason.
But I would think that that the for super-anormalizable model, the flow is kind of finite, isn't it?
It's not exactly a flow. The coupling constant itself doesn't move, if you like.
Yeah.
The scaling variant coupling constant goes to zero in the.
All right.
So that is the one which is the analog of.
Okay. All right. You see the benefits for any zone share. You can have discussion between
it. Add a lot more of AF in this table.
Yeah, maybe. In fact, actually. All right. So so far here is the same class of model. I just try to summarize in the same table. Well, all this part is the same as before. That two guys, I just put them there. That's a gauge invariant people, you know. And all those guys here are just not proved totally. The proof is not finished, but we are quite confident that there will be just a normalizable too. So two aspects here. This is where I am, and on that side. All right. First, for the rank strictly bigger than two, you have these new class of models with one tower of super normalizable model. Okay, the tower, the level of your tower is given by the maximum valence of your vertex. All right. What about matrices? You've got also several matrix models which are renormalizable. And here, I have two towers of just renormalizable matrix models. You have to just choose your unitary invariance up to order k, include all interaction with lower valency without any anomalies in the sense that we discover with Vincent. Well, that you just have to tune your a like this in order to have your renormalizability. One feature, there is no SU2 field, okay, no field over SU2 which can generate renormalizability for a tensorial group field theory with rank strictly bigger than two. But for SU2, you have it here. Okay, what about the UV behavior? Well, all those guys are, again, asymptotically free. What about the matrices? Well, the matrices are more involved. In here, you've got the asymptotic safety at all orders. That's just the Gauss-Vulcanar model in the matrix spaces. Here we have three guys which are asymptotically free at one loop, but we are quite confident that these two guys are kind of, you know, Gauss-Vulcanar model too. At k equals 3, I mean a 5-6 interaction plus a 5-4, etc., well, you hit a Landau Gauss that swap quickly. So are we able to conclude that under the sector's axiom, your asymptotic freedom is a generic feature of tensorial group field theory for a rank strictly bigger than 2? Well, we don't know yet. Why? Just because it's probable, it's really likely that we have a tower of rank 3 model, which are all renormalizable up to infinity. You have just to choose that k up to some order, tune your parameter a to be like this. Well, and then for U1, well, for all even power of that interaction bigger, larger than 4, well, you can have a just renormalizable model. And that will require certainly new tools for understanding that. I don't know if that exists, renormalization by recurrence. But that would be an interesting thing to think of. And, well, thinking about this tower, I was wondering how can I classify my interactions. Okay, is it possible even to count all those invariants, all those, can I just put a list of them, can I understand them? You know, because I need them in order to put a coupling, okay, and try to do the same business. Well, and that we can address in the following way. Actually, Sanjay has a very powerful machinery for understanding Feynman graphs, okay, and that turns, he has developed maybe for the last 10 years several tools on that. And this is the way that you can understand it. You pick
T, N tensor of, you know, simple one, and N tensor T bar, all right? And actually, a tensor invariant is nothing but a contraction. You know, those indices are distinguished. So you have to use free permutations, and that glues those different indices, well, in that funny way. Okay, you can do that. And now, actually, the number of invariants is nothing but counting a number of coset classes into some funny permutation group. And how does it work? Take free permutation like this in that Cartesian product of Sn, your permutation group. And actually, that if you want to count the number of invariants, they should be equivalent under that move, where gamma 1 permutes the T and the gamma 2 permutes the T bar. And using that, and well, what you want to count is exactly the number of coset classes into that game, all right? So that's a double coset space. You want to count the point in that. And exactly that is governed by, you know, counting orbits, counting things like this. Well, you know, fixed points are governed by what we call the Burnside lemma. And you can use the Burnside lemma in order to trade that counting in terms of conjugacy classes of permutation groups. And that you can do. And that the conjugacy class of permutation groups are just determined by partition of N, which just determine the cycle structure of your permutation. And well, this is the result for Z, for the counting for Z equal 3. I mean, the rank 3 case, but that is extendable. Well, you can do it for any D. OK, so this is exactly the number of invariants that Razvan Tor, yeah?
Are they also the disconnected invariants?
Yes, everything here is disconnected. If you want to have the connected one, you have to use the platistic logarithm. Mm-hmm. Or platistic logarithm. I prefer to say it in French. The platistic, and this is the seconds for disconnected one. We have the seconds of connected one. You can add everything in here, even the colored symmetric one. All right? All right, so let me have my last point. Okay. Okay, in fact, because of this relation, okay, and the Burnside lemma, you are able to recast this counting in terms of a partition function of a permutation topological field theory. I mean, a topological field theory using a discrete group like Sn. And this is it. All right? How does it work? Well, you take this guy, it's counting, actually, the Burnside lemma just tells you you have to count conjugacy class, which are nothing but, if you wish, you have to think about them as just sum over fixed points. Okay, of some group action. And fix a point, if you use the fixed point action from this point and this one, you see I have to invert the sigma 1 over there. Now, it's just counting kind of free delta function. You have to sum of permutation groups here. You have free delta function where you integrate one over them. Well, you end up exactly on that. And that's exactly topological field theory of a particular cellular complex made with two cells joined on one edge. All right, and from that, well, maybe one day I can climb my tower. Okay, thank you very much for your attention.
Can
you go back to your last is there any of people want to before these two guys? Yes. Yeah.
I wanted to see your last transparency. I want to see that. Okay,
so that's 5k to the 1. K, you know, I have a tower of models, so I want to go up to infinity there. Maybe one by one. All right. No, maybe another question. No question? Okay, rather, sorry. All right.
So these numbers down there,
yeah.
The numbers of disconnected invariants with vertices.
Yes, that's the one. N equals 2, actually, that goes, yes, N equals, N equals. Okay, that has been made for n equals 1, but you have to multiply by 2. So, yeah, that's 2 vertices.
Four?
No, 2, yeah. No. Yes. 2, 4, yeah. 2, 4, 6, etc. Yes. That's, yeah. Yeah.
some of these invariants have a positivity. Or are reflection symmetric and others are not?
Yeah.
Is there a way in this list
actually,
to select the ones which have a reflection?
Actually, you can, there are several questions that you can ask. Okay. And we have several types of counting in that paper. That's just incredible what you can do with that. And you have to find a way to understand those permutation at the first level. How can you constrain this equivalence relation? Okay. At this point, I cannot tell you, okay, you say symmetry, I need to think about exactly how do you implement this gluing and now try to see maybe that's an internal symmetry or, you know, how do you divide this guy in two? I don't know how to think about it right away, but it's certainly constraining that first equivalence class.
Because somehow stability is related to positivity. In the sense that positivity is typically what gives you the Lambda boost. Then you might have, of course, the wave function which goes the other way around, and you have some model, you can overcome it. But just like you constrain p squared or p to the 2a, you might as well constrain the interactions by this. We see.
Yeah.
It's a possibility.
Yeah. You might. Yes.
And go to the table.
The table, all right.
What's in the place of Tanaza
the multi-orientable model?
Yes.
No, it's not here. That's a colored one. That's only, I'm just using here colored theory. The multi-orientable model does not fit into that. Well, I don't think that they have proved the renormalizability. So it could be a new class of model again, okay? But they didn't have proved yet the renormalizability.
In my opinion, if you take the matrix model that you represent in the bottom, you can also incorporate it, the translation invariant
model
of Lasso and Tanaza.
Is it written in the matrix models? They are not written in the matrix model. Okay, they are written in the momentum space. Maybe if there is an equivalent of that, it wouldn't fit in that category yet. It would fit in what I called an anisotropic model, because you know there is one. I think it's a p squared. one or p squared. So the two. I don't know if
the propagator is not clearly
is well distributed. I don't know over the stronzes. I don't know that. Yeah.
But the interaction certainly is a matrix.
All right. Okay. More questions?
Hey, I had one for about the topological field theory. So could you reinterpret this in some way as some kind of SNB theory on a torus?
Yes, it's a double torus joined along a point.
Okay.
All right, so you have that guy. All right, I have to be careful here. Something like this, and one like this. All right, this is the gamma in the middle. Okay, you have two guys, sigma 1 and sigma 2. I have two generators. Okay, so let me put here sigma 1, sigma 1, sigma 2. Okay, let me put sigma 1 here, and sigma 2. So if I'm doing it, wait a minute. I have two sigma, no, I'm wrong. Okay, I have two sigmas. This should be a gamma minus one, and this is a gamma minus one, and this should be a sigma one and a sigma two over there. There we go. It's something like this. So it's two torus. Okay, actually, you can see it like, you know, a flower like this. Do it like that. All right, but you have to identify the two boundaries, you know, for having a periodic guy. So it's a topological field theory onto that guy. Yes?
Is there a relation between the Hahn-Coulomb things and the Collins work on white gap invariant?
Well, I would like to have more interaction with Valentin and for telling me exactly how do you compute that Weikart, and I don't know how. I'm pretty sure that he should have to see with it. I think so. There should be other connection. So we have to talk, guys. All right. Okay. Let's thank Joseph again.